Why are so many black homeowners in Detroit losing their homes to foreclosure?
Since 2009, one in three homes have completed the property tax foreclosure process. One in three. We have not seen this number of property tax foreclosures in American history since the Great Depression. So the question is, what in the world is going on?
That's Professor Bernadette Atuahaney. We talk with her about her book, Plundered, How Racist Policies Undermine Black Homeownership in America. Then, how to keep from getting overwhelmed by all the ways Trump 2.0 is dismantling America, not to speak of all the other catastrophes going on.
The phrases I came up with were selective denial, so long as it's accompanied by selective attention. And then that can be a winning combination that I think is ethical and allows you to stay grounded, protect yourself, stay in the game, but also to pay attention to what you need to pay attention to in order to make a difference on a chosen front, on a chosen issue.
We bring Andrew Boyd back on Writer's Voice to talk about his viral Substack post, We Shall Not Be Overwhelmed, How Selective Denial Can Help Us Survive Trump 2.0. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Professor Bernadette Atuahaney moved to Detroit, she planned to study the city's squatting phenomenon. What she accidentally found was too urgent to ignore. Her neighbors, many of whom had owned their homes for decades, were losing them to property tax foreclosure, leaving once bustling black neighborhoods blighted with vacant homes. Through years of investigation and research, Atuahaney uncovered a system of predatory governance where public officials raise public dollars through laws and processes that produce or sustain racial inequity, a nationwide practice in no way limited to Detroit. In her book, Plundered, Atuahaney shows how predatory governance eviscerates communities and widens the racial wealth gap. By following the lives of two Detroit grandfathers, one black and the other white, and their grandchildren, Atuahaney tells a riveting tale about racist policies, how they take root, why they flourish, and who profits. Bernadette Atuahaney is a professor of law, a documentary filmmaker, and a community organizer. She co-founded the Coalition for Property Tax Justice in Detroit. Bernadette Atuahaney, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
In this book, Plundered, you use the example of Detroit to reveal a phenomenon that is grossly underreported, and actually I didn't know anything about it, how local governments fill their public treasuries through racist policies that keep black residents in poverty, something that you call predatory governance. You tell the book through the means of the stories of people. There's a lot of information as well in addition to that, but you follow several stories. One of the characters you follow in this book, Plundered, is Myresha Brown, and you actually start back with her grandfather. You contrast two families, but let's just start out with Myresha. Tell us about her, what happened to her and her neighborhood, and why.
So the concept that I create in this book is called predatory governance, and that's when local governments intentionally or unintentionally raise public dollars through racist policies. And Myresha's story really helps us to illustrate that concept. In 2008, Myresha Brown inherited her grandparents' home, which was dilapidated due to redlining and other racist policies that systematically deprive majority Black neighborhoods of valuable investment. Then city officials overvalued and overtaxed the homes in Detroit, leading to historic levels of property tax foreclosure. Since 2009, one in three homes have completed the property tax foreclosure process. One in three. We have not seen this number of property tax foreclosures in American history since the Great Depression. So the question is, what in the world is going on? Well, one of my studies found that between 2009 and 2015, in each of these 7 years, the city of Detroit inflated the value of 53 to 84% of its homes in violation of the Michigan State Constitution. The lowest valued homes, like Myresha's inheritance, got hit the hardest. So in Wayne County, of its 43 municipalities, three have a population that is 70% or more African-American. That's Detroit, Inkster, and Highland Park. And all three have experienced illegally inflated property tax assessments and record numbers of tax foreclosures, as opposed to the 33 cities in Wayne County with a population that's 70% or more white. These cities have not experienced these illegally inflated property taxes and record-setting tax foreclosures. So most importantly, Detroit is ground zero for a national problem. Recent research has found that Blacks and Hispanics pay, on average, a 10 to 13% higher property tax rate than whites, which equals $300 to $400 more per year. The overpayments by Myresha and other Black and Hispanics are quintessential examples of predatory governance, because these local governments are intentionally or unintentionally raising public dollars through written and unwritten laws and processes that produce or sustain racial inequity.
You've mentioned that other places, white neighborhoods, white cities, don't experience this in the same way. And there was overassessment of these properties. But in Detroit, there are places where there is also some underassessment going on in different kinds of neighborhoods. Tell us about that.
That's exactly right. So that's something that we call, the term we use for that is regressivity. And so that's when the lower valued homes are being taxed at a higher rate than the higher valued homes. So when the lower valued homes are being taxed at a higher rate than the highest valued homes. And the University of Chicago Center for Municipal Finance did a nationwide study measuring regressivity in all 50 states, and Michigan was the second worst in our union. And it fell right behind Alabama, and it was right ahead of Mississippi. And I like to say, if you're behind Alabama and ahead of Mississippi on any kind of list that deals with civil rights or justice issues, you know you're in trouble. So Michigan is in big trouble. So it's not just in Detroit where we're seeing that, again, these lower valued homes are being tax at a higher rate than the higher valued homes. It's through the entire state of Michigan.
And take us through this process of assessment and overassessment of these homes. It's not just that they're overassessed, but also that people aren't getting their notices on time. So talk about, how does somebody lose their home? What are some of the typical ways that homes are being lost?
So what happened in Detroit is there was, you know, through the research I did, and also the Detroit News did a big expose, and they found, you know, we all found that these property taxes in Detroit violated the Michigan State Constitution, which quite clearly says no property should be valued at more than 50% of its market value. And so other kind of state constitutions and other laws in other places say things like property tax assessments have to be fair, uniform, equal, which means it's up to a judge to determine legality. In Michigan, because of this ratio, it means people like me can come in and crunch the numbers. So that's how we found that 53 to 84% of homes between 2009 and 2015 were being assessed in violation of the Michigan State Constitution. So what lots of people know is that Detroit gets taken over by the state during emergency management, as part of the bankruptcy. But what lots of people don't know is, because of this rampant illegality that I'm describing to you, the State Tax Commission takes over Detroit's assessment division. And they only got back control in 2017 because they finally finished a 60-year overdue parcel by parcel reassessment of every single property in the city. And so why was that so sorely needed? Because, you know, there's such a high turnover of property. So what an assessment division is supposed to be doing is going into the field every 3 to 5 years to confirm the features of the home and the condition of the home, right? So that they can attach the correct value to that home. But in the middle of the bankruptcy, there were lots of things going on, right? In 2009, the mortgage foreclosure crisis happens and prices decline nationally. They take a precipitous decline nationally. But because of predatory mortgage lending in Black and brown neighborhoods, the housing prices take a really deep dive and they never recover. So that's what's happening in Detroit. That's what happened in Detroit. And this is the very same time that Detroit is going through the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. So the city of Detroit doesn't have the resources it needs, the people power to get out in the field and do these site visits. And they don't have the people power necessary to really get these assessments right, to get the values of the homes right. So they resorted to some kind of ad hoc system where they were just adjusting things, but it wasn't based on value. And they've admitted this on several occasions, the assessment division, as well as the mayor. You know, during this time, the assessments were systematically incorrect. Everyone knows that, and no one is fighting that fact. But you mentioned that the assessment notices weren't coming in on time. That specifically, when they did the reassessment in 2017, that specific year when they did the assessment notices, in fact, did not come in on time. And we filed a lawsuit called Howard that addresses that particular issue that happened in that year when the assessments didn't come on time in 2017. But the larger problem is a problem of, it has everything to do with the mortgage foreclosure crisis and property values changing and declining so drastically, and that this bureaucracy not having the people power to do the adjustments that were necessary. That's the big story as to why we have these systemic overassessments in the city of Detroit and in other Black cities, because of Wayne County has 43 municipalities. Three, Detroit, Inkster, and Highland Park, as I mentioned, have a supermajority of Black people, and 33 have a supermajority of white people. And again, it's not just Detroit, it is all of the Black municipalities in Wayne County are experiencing these illegally inflated property taxes.
So, Professor Atuaheni, in Plundered, How Racist Policies Undermine Black Home Ownership in America, you go far beyond or far before the Great Recession, the foreclosure crisis in the early 2000s, because you really are taking, this is really a book about systemic racism, albeit shining a light on one key aspect of it. But there are many policies and many ways in which Black home ownership in America had already been undermined. So I wonder if you could just set it up for us with the example of Detroit. I mean, in many ways, Detroit was one place where Black families could get ahead because of the auto industry. So and there was some prosperity that was built, and then so much of it was lost. So give us a bit of the historical background of systemic racism to this whole home ownership problem in Detroit.
So Plundered is the story of two grandfathers who were both once poor sharecroppers in their native lands. Both came to Detroit to work at Ford Motor Company's River Rouge factory in the early 1900s. One, Grandpa Bucci, was white and he came from Italy. The other, Grandpa Brown, was Black and he came from North Carolina. So River Rouge was one of Ford Motor Company's dirtiest and most dangerous factories. Nevertheless, the job helped these two men and their families escape poverty and enter the middle class. So although neither grandfather had an easy life, the book goes through how racist policies affected the Black grandfather's ability to pass along wealth to his grandchildren, while the Italian grandfather and his descendants were allowed to thrive. The racist policies I'm talking about include racially restrictive covenants, redlining, blockbusting, urban renewal, predatory mortgage lending, and most recently, inequitable property taxation, which we just discussed. So I call these racist policies because they're written and unwritten laws and processes that produce or sustain racial inequity. And racist policies exist regardless of intentions. So although Plundered begins with Detroit and the Ford Motor Company, it's not just about Detroit. It's a national story about how racist policies undermine Black home ownership in America.
And one of the points that you make is that when the Black Lives Matter movement began back in, well, it must have predated Ferguson, but I remember that was one of the first big ones, that the Black Lives Matter movement shines a light on racist policing policies that assault Black bodies, but that this is much more of a hidden form of assault that is not talked about. Why do you think that's so? Why has this not been revealed in the way that the other has?
Absolutely. So partly it's because when you think about police violence, you can record that on your cell phone, right? And that's how Black people who've been victim to this police violence knew it was going on all along. But others who were not aware of it were made aware of it through this cell phone footage. We don't have anything like that for what I'm talking about. So let me give you an example. In Detroit, you know, a yellow bag hanging in front of a home is a universal sign of property tax foreclosure, right? And that's on the book cover, you see the yellow bag. And the yellow bag provides the legal notice required to foreclose, but it also brings shame because it announces to the entire neighborhood that the homeowner is going through tax foreclosure. So when Myresha saw the yellow bag on her door in 2015, she snatched it down as quickly as she could before the neighbors got wind of what was going on. But when she looked down the block, the yellow bags were attached to the most of her neighbors' doors as well. So this idea that it's hidden, you know, it's not so hidden. But again, since 2009, 1 in 3 Detroit homes have completed the property tax foreclosure process. So city officials really explain the property tax foreclosure crisis with stories of personal irresponsibility. For instance, one official said, Detroiters just don't want to pay their property taxes. Another said, Detroiters bought homes they couldn't afford. One official even had the audacity to say that Detroiters decided to buy purses instead of paying their property taxes. And I interviewed over 150 Detroit homeowners who lost their homes to tax foreclosure, and I found that most of them had internalized these narratives of personal irresponsibility. Mind you, people are losing legacy homes that have been paid off. And if there was a mortgage on the home, the bank would have taken it before the local government could. So tax foreclosed homeowners blame themselves for losing mama's house or losing granddaddy's house. There was so much shame and self-lambasting that when the interview was over, I called many people back to tell them about my study and the illegally inflated property tax assessments. I let them know that systemic injustice was hidden in the complex property tax calculations. And this information allowed them to shift from blaming themselves to focusing on the structural injustices involved. And this shift lifted the shame, allowed them to stop beating themselves up, and made room for righteous indignation so the fight back could begin. So Myresha did not have a yellow bag on her door because she was irresponsible. She was up against racist policies, which operate silently in the background, leaving its victims foregrounded and thus drawing all the blame. Everyone can see the yellow bags, but they cannot see the practices and policies that made sure these yellow bags were on almost every door on Myresha's block.
Oh, I mean, it's a blame the victim, a classic case. So what happened to Myresha's house? It was a house that she inherited. Give us a brief history of that house.
So Myresha, she inherits her grandparents' home. And instead of inheriting an asset worth a lot of money. So there's the two grandfathers I described to you. One is Grandpa Brown, and Myresha is his descendant and inherited his house. The other is Grandpa Bucci, and Robert Facano inherits his house. So the house that the Italian, Robert Facano, inherits is a house in one of the suburbs in Detroit, and it's worth a lot of money. The house that Myresha inherits in Detroit is really a money pit. Why? And again, it's because of layers and layers of racist policies. So number one, the first thing you have, in these particular areas, we had what's called racial covenants, which is did not allow Black people to live in certain areas. And so Black people had limited areas where they could live. So once racial covenants corralled Blacks into these very specific neighborhoods, then we have redlining that comes along and says that any community that has too many Black people, they draw a red line around that neighborhood. And that red line means that they don't get valuable investment. They don't get mortgages. They don't get home improvement loans. They don't get business loans. They don't get capital because these overwhelmingly Black neighborhoods are considered a credit risk. And so when you don't have capital coming into any community, there's no other result than that community crumbling, right? The housing in that community becomes dilapidated. And that's exactly what happened in the neighborhood that the Browns lived in and that Myresha inherited her house in. So what she inherited, again, was a money pit because the maintenance hadn't been done, because the capital wasn't coming into the community because of redlining. So, and although Grandpa Bucci, you know, he lost his finger at the River Rouge factory, you know, he did not at all have an easy life, and Italians faced lots of discrimination. But the thing that Grandpa Bucci and his descendants did not have to deal with were these racist policies like redlining, like racial covenants, like blockbusting. And so Myresha inherits a money pit. She then tries to, because she's committed to the home, she's committed to her legacy, she's committed to the city of Detroit. So she tries to rehabilitate the home. And she's undermined because of the latest chapter in this history of racist policies, which are illegally inflated property taxes. Her property taxes were being illegally inflated. So not only was she falling behind on her property tax bill, but the state of Michigan puts a 18% interest penalty on delinquent property tax debt, making it almost impossible for people to climb out of property tax debt. So instead of the money going for home improvements, the money is going to, in these neighborhoods, to these paying off these illegally inflated property taxes. So the end of the story, although Myresha is literally superhuman, like she does everything she's supposed to do. She works so hard. She's carrying so many people. She has so many caretaking responsibilities, but she's still caring for all these people. And she's caring for the home. Despite her Herculean efforts, she loses the home to property tax foreclosure. And that's what happens to Myresha's home.
I just want to ask you, as I was reading this book, and it's really wonderfully written, Plundered, How Racist Policies Undermine Black Home Ownership in America, and we are talking with Bernadette Atuahene, the author. As I was reading it, I could feel my blood pressure rise. I mean, it's so unfair. It's so unjust. People work so hard, and they are just, you know, beat down at every turn. What was it like for you to listen to these stories?
Yeah, oh my goodness. So I had to do quite a bit of self-care. Yeah, these stories are infuriating. What's happening in Detroit and many other Black and Brown cities is absolutely infuriating. So when I'm interviewing people, and again, I did over 150 interviews of people who lost their home for property taxes they were not supposed, illegally inflated property taxes that they weren't supposed to be paying in the first place because they qualified for something called the poverty tax exemption. And the city of Detroit made this entitlement so difficult for people to access that, again, lots of people lost their homes for property taxes they weren't supposed to be paying in the first place. And I can tell you about the lawsuit a little bit later that we did. But when I'm interviewing people, I mean, again, like I said, people are beating themselves up because they lost mama's home. These are legacy homes. I lost granddaddy's home. They're crying, and I'm an empath, so I'm crying with them. You know, we're crying together. And I can't mess up my data, so we finished the interview. And like I said, I then hung up the phone and called many of them back to say, I need you to stop beating yourself up. I've done a study, and it shows very clearly that these property taxes were illegally inflated, and you were dealing with paying these illegally inflated property taxes that you couldn't afford, because about 30% of Detroiters live below the poverty line. And this just, again, this callback I had to do just to lift the shame from people, because they had internalized these narratives of personal responsibility, blaming themselves, beating themselves up. And so, you know, I had to do personally a lot of self-care as I was doing these interviews, because as you said, just reading the book, right, your blood pressure went up. Imagine me doing all the groundwork and all the interviews and hearing all these stories firsthand. You know, it was something else. You know, it was really, really, it took a toll hearing these stories. But, you know, I had to listen to them. The people I was interviewing had to live through it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the fight back then. You mentioned, I mean, we spoke a bit about the lawsuit. Tell us a little more about that, or whatever you want to tell us about it, and where it is right now. What happened? And did any of the folks that you spoke with in the book, you know, ultimately benefit or join the fight?
Yeah. So we have something that's called the Coalition for Property Tax Justice. And it's a coalition of about a dozen different Detroit grassroots organizations. And we have three goals. The first is to stop these unconstitutional property tax assessments. The second is to stop the ongoing foreclosures until we can make sure everyone is taxed the correct amount. And the third is to provide compensation. And so we've had lots of successes. So on the first one about stopping these illegally inflated property tax assessments, we have something called the Property Tax Appeal Project, where my students and I actually appeal the property taxes for free for owner occupiers. We don't service landlords. And we appeal the property taxes for free of people who are being overassessed. And last year alone, we did appeals for 550 Detroit homeowners, me and my team of students. And what's so interesting is those 550, and the year before, we've been operating since 2017. And the beautiful thing is that people who we service with these property tax appeals come back and organize with us. They come back and fight with us to fight for other reforms. So, for instance, one of the other reforms we were able to win is called we've successfully passed two pieces of legislation through Detroit City Council. The first was around this poverty tax exemption, making sure that these unnecessary barriers that the city of Detroit was erecting are no longer. And the most recent we passed last year is called the Property Tax Reform Ordinance. And that does lots of things like making the property tax bill legible to the average Detroiter, right? Instead of in 10-point font, 12-point font, giving definitions for things so people can have the information they need to make their own assessment as to whether they're being overassessed. We make filing an appeal as easy as tearing a tear off where they can submit. But the big thing about the Property Tax Reform Ordinance is it forces the city to do annually something called the Assessment Ratio Study. So we've passed that. We have also had a lot of success with foreclosures. Ever since 2020, we have successfully, through, again, groundwork and community organizing, prevented the foreclosure of owner-occupied homes in 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023, and we also were successful in 2024. Again, every year, all neighbors come together, and we have made sure no foreclosures have happened in those years. And as third and final goal with compensation, we started something called the Dignity Restoration Project, which is raising $10 million to compensate the hardest hit Detroiters like Myresha, right, who lost their homes for tax foreclosure due to illegally inflated property taxes that they were not supposed to be paying in the first place because they qualified for the property tax exemption. So listeners can go to dignityrestorationproject.org to donate. Your contributions send a message to people like Myresha, who unfairly lost their home, saying, I see you and I affirm your dignity. So, you know, Detroit is ground zero for a national problem, but I need everyone to understand that Detroit is also ground zero for the fight back. And not only do we have all of these things we're doing at the city level, but we have solutions that we're moving forward at the state level. And we, Representative Rashida Tlaib, our congresswoman, has put us, we had two meetings with Marsha Fudge at HUD because we have national solutions coming out of our movement as well.
Did I hear you right? You said there were no foreclosures in the last year?
Owner-occupied homes. Again, you know, it's one thing when you lose the home you live in. So where, you know, there were many landlords that lost homes and we're not fighting on their behalf. We're fighting on behalf of people who are losing the homes they live in.
That is so impressive. So you said you're working on the state level. Now, we're entering a true time of darkness on the national level. But nonetheless, what are some of the reforms that you would like to see both on the state level and the national level?
So on the state level, in Michigan, they have, I told you, Michigan is the second most regressive state in the union, according to the data from the University of Chicago. And so they have something, they have an audit that they do every 5 years. And so one of our solutions is saying, hey, we already have what we call regressivity metrics. We're saying add these regressivity metrics into your audit. And if any municipality or locality falls outside of the internationally accepted ranges, put them on a corrective action plan. And so Michigan already has an audit system, and we're saying just add these regressivity metrics to it. So that's a really low-hanging fruit solution as we see it at the state level. At the national level, again, the University of Chicago Center for Municipal Finance has created a database where you can actually go to their website, hover over your wherever you live, and you can see if where you live is regressive. You can see if where you live, the lower valued homes are paying a higher property tax rate than the higher valued homes. So that's step one. And we want HUD, we spoke with Marsha Fudge, asking her two things. Number one, we want HUD to take, you know, work with the University of Chicago to further develop and disseminate this online resource that they have created. We want to add race to it because at the moment it doesn't have race added to it. And the second thing is for the top 10% of offenders nationally, we want HUD to put them on a corrective action plan. You know, because a lot of these assessors are great people. They're working hard. They're dealing with legacy systems from the 1980s, and they're not using simple things like regression analysis. And so it's really about giving these assessors the modern tools they need for accuracy. And so that's the two-step national solution. Again, number one, giving people information as to whether these property taxes in their area are inequitable. And number two, putting the worst offenders on a corrective action plan and giving them the resources they need to develop accurate property tax assessments. So that's our national level solution that we're pushing forward.
So going back to the lawsuit, tell us a little bit more about it and where it stands.
Yeah. So with the lawsuit, we literally had the legal dream team. We had the ACLU of Michigan. We had the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And we had the law firm of Covington and Burling. And there were two claims made. One claim was against was a Fair Housing Act claim against the county for basically a disparate impact because of the, you know, what I just described, how the majority Black cities in Wayne County were being illegally assessed and foreclosed on at a far greater rate than the white cities. So the Fair Housing Act is one of the few places where disparate impact is still alive. And so that case has never been heard by a court till this day. Why? They went first, Judge Colombo says, you weren't supposed to bring this case to state court. You're supposed to bring this case to the Michigan Tax Tribunal. The case goes on appeal. The appellate court agrees. The case goes on appeal to the Michigan Supreme Court, and they don't grant cert, which means that the lower court decision stands. And that lower court decision, it's called an improper venue. It kills the case for three reasons. Number one, the Michigan Tax Tribunal is an administrative agency. It's not a court. The judges are actually real estate agents. They're not even lawyers. And so number one, the Michigan Tax Tribunal, because it's not a court, it doesn't have what we call injunctive power. And that's the power of courts to tell entities to do something or stop doing something. And that's the whole remedy we wanted, was to tell the city of Detroit and Wayne County to stop illegally assessing people and foreclosing on people. Number two, because it's not a court and it's an administrative agency, the Michigan Tax Tribunal doesn't have the class action facility. So you have to litigate one by one by one, and there's no solution for systemic injustice, which is what we were trying to get at in this case. It's called Morningside. And third and final, while the Fair Housing Act has a 2-year statute of limitations, because it takes a lot to get the evidence to put these cases together, in the Michigan Tax Tribunal, you had 15 days to put together a case, because in Detroit, you had to submit an appeal between February 1st and February 15th in order to get to the Michigan Tax Tribunal. So through this procedural decision saying that the legal team couldn't sue in state court, they had to sue in at this tribunal, in this administrative agency, it kills the case. So although we have reams and reams of data proving these systematic, illegally inflated property tax assessments, proving the racially disparate impact, till this day, no court has heard this information because of these procedural barriers I'm describing. And we couldn't even take the case to federal court because of something called the Tax Injunction Act, which bars federal courts from looking at state tax-related issues. That's why we were in state court in the first place. So because of these legal complexities, something that is so clearly illegal that the director of the assessment division has admitted this illegality has occurred, the mayor of Detroit, Mayor Mike Duggan, has admitted this illegality has occurred, but this dream team, again, ACLU of Michigan, NAACP Legal Defense Fund in Covington and Burling, were unsuccessful in bringing a legal claim because of these procedural issues. Unbelievable.
That is such an injustice. And yet you are making changes nonetheless.
That's it. So we knew we couldn't because the courts were closed. That's why, you know, I'm a professor, but before I went to law school, I was a community organizer in South Central LA. So I had to roll up my sleeves and we got together and we were like, we got to start organizing because the legal the law is not going to provide solutions. So we've got to go to the political arena to get solutions for this clear injustice. And that's exactly what we have done through the Coalition for Property Tax Justice.
Oh, that's so important. And I understand that you're actually writing a sequel to this book detailing some of these solutions and the fight back. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So it's funny you say it's a sequel. When I was writing this book, they gave me a 100,000 word limit. And so I was looking at 160,000 words that I had written. And then I was just like, oh my God, I can't cut this. Like, you know, I was like, I can't cut 60,000 words. And so it just, this is actually two books because I was at, 160,000 words and I hadn't even put a dent in describing our movement. And so I was like, okay, this is two books. So the first book describes a problem. And then the second book really describes all of this community organizing that we have been doing to really address this problem.
Well, we'll have to have you back on the show when that book comes out.
I would love to come back.
Well, Professor Bernadette Atuahene, you are the author of Plundered. This has been such a great conversation. And I want to thank you so much for writing this important book and talking with us about it.
Thank you for having me on.
Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about Professor Atuahene's work on foreclosures. Now, let's listen to a clip from a Democracy Now! Segment 5 years ago on the work of the Coalition for Property Tax Justice. Anchor Juan Gonzalez introduces a homeowner, mother of seven, who lost her home.
This is lifelong Detroit resident Sandra Bonet speaking during a press conference on Thursday. In 2015, her home was illegally foreclosed by Wayne County, which includes the city of Detroit.
You right now, what I tell the community every time I go out, it feels very personal to lose your home. You feel like you did something very wrong, like you just couldn't keep it together. But once I was informed by Professor Atuahene that the city illegally and unconstitutionally took my home, oh, it lit a fire. And we began fighting. And this is where this fight has brought us. So I want to leave you with a couple of things today. Number one, this is an 85% black city. This would not be happening if this city was 85% white. You better believe that. Two is, land is so very important. And they are stealing your land. We cannot let them get away with this yet again, because Lord knows they've stolen enough land.
That was Sandra Bonet speaking in 2015. Next up, we shall not be overwhelmed. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Back in 2023, we spoke with Andrew Boyd about how to keep from getting overwhelmed by the climate emergency. He's the author of a book on the subject called I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. Last week, he wrote an article for his Substack, The Tragic Optimist, about how to deal with the political catastrophe we're facing now. The one with Trump and his cabinet of billionaires mounting a coup against our republic that threatens to destroy anything that helps ordinary Americans so that they and their billionaire buddies can get a $4 trillion tax cut. So I called up Andrew Boyd to talk about his post, We Shall Not Be Overwhelmed, How Selective Denial Can Help Us Survive Trump 2.0. Andrew Boyd, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
First of all, when people ask you how you're doing, you contrast the way it was during the first Trump administration and now the second one. What's the difference?
Well, they're both pretty terrible, right? So it's like, when people kind of go, yeah, I think everyone's familiar with this situation. People go, hey, how are you doing? And then you sort of, you're about to launch into, your own little personal world of like, hey, I'm doing fine, nobody's sick in the family, whatever. And then you kind of like stop halfway before you even get a word out. And you're like, oh my God, the world is unraveling. The world is falling apart. There's a authoritarian that the people of America have just voted into office and destroying America or what we believed most cherished about America from the inside. And you're kind of like, you catch yourself and, you realize how actually terrible in many ways you are doing. And so it's like, yeah. And so it's even worse this time. And I think the last time it was like, the world's a mess, but I'm okay. Kind of a little chuckle and we're going to get through this and it's so great. And now it feels, it's almost like you're stuck for words, it's like, oi, fucking hell. And then people will also ask you this via text. And instead of saying, hey, I'm hanging in, which is what I think I often say, sometimes I'll actually, if it's a dearer friend or if I'm in that sort of more thoughtful moment, and I mentioned this in the piece, and I'll type out something like, I'm often sad in the morning, when I seem to be more porous to reality, both the global situation and my own. But once I go about my getting stuff done day, I manage to do okay, good even. Sometimes I can even have a great day. And that's the contradiction, that the piece picks up from.
Yeah. And, I have to say, the day I read this article, somebody who I know, and he's also someone who publishes a really excellent blog, but I won't say his name because I haven't asked his permission, DM'd me and said, how are you doing? I'm actually freaking out. And so I sent him a link to your article because one of the things you talk about here is actually what I've been doing. First of all, I've put myself on a news diet, which is very unusual for me, and I've compartmentalized. So talk about first this way of coping, the news diet and the compartmentalization.
I think there's first just noting that compartmentalization feels wrong somehow. It feels like a moral failure at some level. Like it's sort of it's like your very top down repressive kind of way to approach things. So there's a little resistance to it. Shouldn't we be open to everything? Shouldn't our circle of concern be as wide as possible? Shouldn't we bring our full humanity to all that there is? So it's a bit contrarian or uncomfortable initially, but it's actually a very powerful way to focus and filter and protect yourself while staying engaged.
Yeah. So those are keeping those things in balance, staying engaged and protecting oneself to a certain extent. On the one hand, you talk about how you decluttered an entire drawer, and I can totally relate to that. But yeah. You were asked a very important question by a student when you were, giving a guest lecture. And she asked you, how am I supposed to care? What did she mean, and what was your answer?
She was talking about feeling overwhelmed. This is a year ago, before Trump 2.0 know. But, you know, there's a lot to feel overwhelmed about, regardless of having the worst possible president, worst possible human in America, you know, be president. And she was talking about particularly how it felt on her social feeds, where just brutal images from the Israeli bombardment of Gaza were coming in, just, you know, climate doom scrolling, friends without without any health insurance, you know, putting up GoFundMe pages, you know, in order to take care of their basic health care. Thing like this, one after another, coming through her digital life, her world, you know, which is so much a larger share of our world than it has been in previous generations. And she was just overwhelmed and over solicited, and, you know, her whole being and heart were fatigued. She couldn't focus. She cared about everything, but then couldn't care because she couldn't focus. And she wanted to know how to care, given that all of these different things were unraveling, falling apart, so many different people suffering in so many different ways and places all at the same time. And so she wanted to know how to care. And it felt like she was asking this question that everybody's asking, you know, given the attention economy and polarized politics and just this sort of moment, as they call it, a time of monsters in world history. And, you know, so she was asking for herself, but for everyone. And, you know, I was like, whoa, I felt very, it sobered me up. And this was an important, I had to bring my best self, my best wisdom forward, because this was a very crux moment. And all the other kids were sort of hanging on that answer as well. And so I said, it was okay to protect her heart with denial and compartmentalization, which wasn't exactly the answer she or the professor or I, in a certain way, even I was expecting. But I felt that the phrases I came up with were selective denial, so long as it's accompanied by selective attention. And then that can be a winning combination that I think is ethical and allows you to stay grounded, protect yourself, stay in the game, but also to pay attention to what you need to pay attention to in order to make a difference on a chosen front, on a chosen issue, on a chosen effort. So she had to figure out what her one thing was that she was going to pay attention to and act on. And then she could let all that gruesome information, whatever she needed to know and learn, she could learn about that one thing. And even if it sort of was heartbreaking, and then so long as she was acting on that one thing, then all this other stuff coming at her wouldn't feel so terrible, because she was doing something to make a difference somewhere. And she had to trust that other people were taking care of all the other things that she can't pay attention to because she was focused on her one thing, that this sort of ecosystem of resistance, this social movement of movements, the beloved community was taking care of everything else, and that all these other terrible things coming at her wouldn't mess up her conscience as much, because one, she was acting on one thing and making a difference there, and then trusting that others would act on the other things. So that seems appropriate for our moment here in Trump 2.0. And based on all the responses I and where it's been reposted have been getting on the Substacks and on the internet and everywhere on the various social platforms, it's really struck a nerve, and people have said, this really helped me. This gives me direction. This helps me orient myself and take care of myself and fight, actually.
So what's your one focus?
Well, it doesn't have to just be one. It can be a little, you know, a few, and I have a few, but just the basic there is like, it still fits in with the small set of things that you're doing, understanding that that is sufficient and other people will take care of the other things. So the things I'm doing are, I've showed up at a protest on No King's Day, which, you know, we've renamed President's Day to No King's Day. And that was protest all over the country, hundreds of them in state houses and city centers all over. And I was at a protest in the middle of New York City that people expected maybe 500 people at. And there was like 5,000 or more. And no organization was really organizing it. It was just a spontaneous taking the streets by, you know, concerned New Yorkers, concerned Americans. And it was very uplifting, clever slogans, people braving the cold, sort of finding fire in the belly, you know, by being together, that kind of thing. It was great. And it happened all over the country. So that was one thing I did. And then I've been doing like writing the piece, which seems to be sort of helpful and kind of raising morale and giving people sort of spiritual direction, emotional grounding to figure out how they can fight. So that's actually helpful. The piece that we're talking about, We shall not be overwhelmed. And then I've been working on various, one of the things I do in my life has been creative messaging and creative campaigning. And I'm cooking up some things along those lines, along the lines of Trump voters who, all these people who voted for Trump, they voted for America first and they're getting billionaires first, you know. They voted for lower prices and prices are going up. Trump has no intention of lowering those prices. And that's not, you know, that was just a campaign slogan. So that's one kind of campaign messaging. And then, so I'm doing a bunch of creative communications to help peel off some of Donald Trump's soft support as people realize that he was lying to them, basically, about a lot of things.
Well, that's great. You know, I was at one of those demonstrations, too, on Long Island. And, you know, Long Island's a hard place to get a group of people together. And we had about 250 people, which is by far the largest that I've ever seen. I want to just ask you one last thing, something that has been really annoying me, and I just wonder what your take on it is. I've been hearing James Carville, you know, the Democratic strategist of old.
The Raging Cajun.
Yeah, the Raging Cajun, who keeps on saying that Democrats should, quote, play possum. And he's saying the left is screwing it up by doing things like marching in the streets and, you know, complaining about this and that. He says, let's just let Trump hang himself. I don't know. What do you think of that message?
I think it's half of it is correct. But the playing possum part is dead wrong. I think he's right that Trump will overreach. He'll jump the shark. He is already doing so. His numbers are already going down. Musk's numbers in particular are going down. People don't like this playing fast and loose with the Constitution. They don't like selling out Ukraine. They don't like, you know, caving to Putin. That's particularly unpopular. They feel they want to cut government, excess government spending and bureaucracy, whatever that means to them. But they don't want, you know, when it sort of impacts their district, then they are very concerned and have been showing up this last week at both Republican and Democratic town halls with a lot of vitriol, with a lot of questions, with a lot of concern. There's a lot of shouting matches, even in very red districts, you know. So when the – and 80% of, you know, government – federal government employees are – only 20% of government – federal government employees are in D.C. You know, 80% of them are throughout the country. So when, you know, their friends and neighbors and – spouses are being fired, then it feels very different to them. So there is a way in which it's correct in that I think Trump will be his own worst enemy, but playing possum is the wrong way to do that. The thing to do is to oppose. And to, as Bill McKibben would say, and let me quote here, one sec here. Yeah, Bill McKibben would say, our basic job is to make what Trump is doing deeply unpopular. Some of that Trump will do on his own, you know, because it's just evident and he's already got the highest negatives of anyone at this moment in his term, except for his previous term. But it's our job to do that. So the Democrats should do everything they possibly can to throw sand in the gears in D.C., slow everything down, make everything a fight, and not just fight it, but tell the story of how this is fundamentally un-American, fundamentally anti-democratic, fundamentally, you know, pro-billionaire and not pro-average American citizen. So that's the job of the Democrats, and that's our job in the streets, and that's our job on the internet. So there should be, you know, one of the ideas being floated is a daily opposition briefing. You know, in many countries, like in England, they have a shadow cabinet, you know, where there's a shadow minister of the, you know, Secretary of Defense, a shadow Secretary of the Environment, and they offer alternate proposals and speak, you know, and criticize the current ruling government's, you know, mistakes. So, you know, we don't have that here in the U.S. in the same way. So we need to create that. And the Democrats aren't going to do it but like a group like Indivisible might. So a daily opposition briefings to counter program the narrative and to rally the troops and be a sort of constant daily news source for media outlets, both social and mainstream, to, you know, change the narrative. So that's one example. The town halls is another example, and that's already happening. So I think there's a lot of other kinds of resistance that federal workers, that unions, you know, the courts are already resisting, but we'll see how much, you know, that Trump, you know, that's a bit of a possible constitutional crisis area if he ignores the courts. So the courts are very important, but actual people power in the streets is important, and resistance inside the institutions by both rank and file workers, department heads, and unions that protect them, and that protocols on hiring and firing, you know, have to be followed. They're part of union contracts. They're part of federal law, et cetera. So there's a lot of different ways to resist, and we must resist in every way we can imagine. And we must create alternatives. You know, there's majority blue states like California, I think Illinois, for example, with with blue state trifectas that can actually implement alternative policies and show that there's another way at the same time as, you know, the federal government does terrible things. So anyway, those are some thoughts. We should definitely not play possum. We must oppose, do so creatively in every way and shape possible. And I'll say one last thing, just because there's someone I quote about that ties everything together, which is the Swiss psychologist who's been basically saying the same thing about how to handle overwhelm as I did. And I linked to her in my piece. She says, our resistance is our focus. You know, our resistance is our grounding. We can find our mental health in focused resistance. So there you go.
Well, Andrew Boyd, this has been inspiring to talk with you. Your article is in The Tragic Optimist, your blog. The article is We Shall Not Be Overwhelmed. Thanks again for talking with us here.
That's wonderful. And thank you for having me on the show.
And go to writersvoice.net for a link to Boyd's Substack post, as well as to our previous conversation with him about his book, I Want a Better Catastrophe. Next week on Writer's Voice, we begin our programming for Women's History Month. We talk with Alice Rothschild about her memoir, written entirely in free verse, Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. Then we talk with novelist and Shakespeare scholar Grace Tiffany about her feminist novel about Shakespeare's daughter, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.